Delaney Consulting LLC, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses. Visit our website, DelaneyLLC.com, and learn why 100% of Delaney's clients will use our services again. Good morning. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world. This week, CFO.com has announced CFO turnover at big companies dropped by 28% last year as boards shied away from non-essential change and private equity firms slowed their efforts to woo public company executives, according to new data from executive recruiting firm Heidrick & Struggles. Welcome to our show. Today we have Chris Arndt, who joins us to discuss the role of CFO. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Glad to be here.
You've served in some senior roles, Chris, CFO of My Choice Medical, COO of Bargain Network, and previously as AVP Finance for ChoicePoint and Division CFO for ChoicePoint's in-house incubator. You're an active member of Financial Executive International, having served as president of the Atlanta chapter, and you're currently serving as director of the Southeast region. Welcome again to CFO Radio. Chris, tell us a little bit about your background and why you've chosen the CFO path. And
I don't know necessarily if I've chosen the CFO path or if it ended up choosing me at one way or another. In college, I was pre-med. I was political science, economics. I was kind of all over the place, keeping my options open. And I worked in banking for a while after college and started to like the international finance side of things. So got a master's degree here at Georgia State, and after that, decided the best way to understand the finance I'd learned was to go up to New York and do some crisis and turnaround work. So that's really where the passion kicked in. You need to learn business models very quickly, get through them, understand cash flow, what really drives a business beyond a textbook exercise. Plus, New York was a good testing ground. So from that, I kind of evolved, continued the consulting path, went corporate, and started doing mostly all financial work, operationally restructuring, things like that on the corporate side. And so I kind of ended up in that role.
Wonderful, wonderful. And quite a breadth of experiences. So Chris, today, what would you say is the biggest challenge facing the CFO of today?
I think it's dealing with the external forces on your business. You can plan, you can execute on certain things, but some things you can't control. For example, My Choice Medical has a loan portfolio. The business was a business that generated leads for plastic surgeons and also provided financing for those surgeons. And as we looked at managing that portfolio, things would happen beyond your control. So when the banks restricted credit limits, all of a sudden our defaults went through the roof because someone who had a $5,000 credit limit before, now at $4,000, when we post our monthly payment to them, it would automatically bounce back. So it's how do you adapt to things like that? I can't force the banks to increase someone's credit limit, and I end up in a situation where I have to adapt based on an external decision that's out there.
And what did that have as an impact on your role managing the income statement, the balance sheet, and perhaps the reserves?
Well, the biggest challenge in that is the reserves, because if you get involved in reserve analysis, you have different lengths of time. You have to predict your defaults over the next 6 months, in our case, to 9 months for an unsecured loan of that type. And you have to now change your entire forecast because instead of having an X percent, you have X plus 10% because of an external thing. You can't do a whole lot to impact that either because you don't know what's going to happen next.
Looking for the unknown, and that's always the challenge in the forecasting role.
Right.
Did that give you any particular challenge at doing your forecasting function, performing those monthly, quarterly, and future lookouts differently from the average firm?
No, I mean, because the forecast is what it is. It's the accuracy of the forecast. And so, you know, you have a technical event that happens or an event that happens that you can model out. And it's the conversation back with your private equity firm to say, this is probably what's going to happen based on what we now know. So it's really a factor in the forecast, but the math to do the forecast doesn't really change.
So how do you as a CFO in turn support that additional need for reserves, which given the economic climate, I would imagine that's on the increase?
Yeah, at the time, I mean, it was a year ago, November, the challenge was going back. And again, in my scenario, we had a private equity firm that understood what was going on. They're heavily involved with banking as well. So they saw that in their other markets. And then you do go through the exercise of saying, how's mine performing different than other your businesses?
Yes, understand. Well, Chris, the role of the CFO is often a very highly technical one. And in that regard, we often think of the accounting side of a technical role of a CFO. How do you maintain your knowledge in this area? And I perhaps would ask the question that often the controllers of today that would desire to be the CFOs of tomorrow often face the question, do I need to be a CPA? What kind of education do I need to attain?
I think there are different types of CFOs when you look at it. They're your controllership type accounting CFOs, they're your financial CFOs, and then they're your basically treasury type CFOs and banking CFOs. And when you look at those different types, the CPA type and controllership, it's more important. So you're not so much actively involved in product development. You're not involved in a lot of the capital planning that goes on in the business. You're more of a compliance role. Public companies, that's more the hat that those people wear. I'm more of a mid-sized company CFO. And so I keep up on latest trends by talking to consultants, by talking to our accounting firms, by challenging our controller and saying, I don't understand why we do it this way, and then we keep up on that kind of gap.
Yeah, quite a challenge to keep up with all the ever-changing elements of the finance function. And to perhaps in today's world, we're looking at the international markets. Even the mom-and-pop shop very often has an international edge with the internet. Talk about that. Has that impacted your focus of technical strength and capabilities?
Yeah, a little bit. And the challenge, too, when I was at ChoicePoint, we had an overseas division. And so you had to all of a sudden get exposed to hedging strategies and what can you hedge for properly and what's adequate. And that's one of the biggest challenges on the international side. The businesses I dealt with, the last two companies, were local in nature. So I didn't have a lot of that international aspect.
Mm-hmm. And you've worked previously, you talked about some of the earlier years, your formative years, if you will, in your career that you've expanded upon quite strongly in M&A activities, transactions. You were involved in many transactions. Do you think that your experiences in these transactions have helped you to be a better CFO?
Yeah, I think it gives you a unique perspective into make versus buy scenarios and when do you want to buy stuff. On the front end, my M&A experience was, again, right out of graduate school at Ernst & Young doing turnaround work. And one of the first engagements I was on was Macy's. And you're going through a scenario of, can we run this by ourselves or is it a better return for shareholders if we just take these stores and plug them in someplace else? And so that was really my introduction to the M&A world. But I've actively been involved in M&A at Scientific Atlanta and also at ChoicePoint. And ChoicePoint had a very efficient way of buying companies and integrating them. What you learned quickly, though, was that value is negotiable. A smaller company in particular, your model may come up and tell you it's worth $10 million, but at the end of the day, the guy needs $12 million because that's his lifestyle and that's what he's willing to emotionally commit to. And you have to decide how to bridge that gap between the valuation and really what's fair based on your buyer side. The other thing that we learned pretty quickly was you can't forecast out more than 5 years. If you go 3 years with some level of accuracy, that's great. And beyond 5 years is challenging. We've played with 10-year models with no terminal growth rate in them, if you're familiar with valuation. And really, they're almost as accurate as a 5-year model. That's a lot tighter. The other couple things that I think help you as CFO is you don't just do the transaction. You end up buying in yet in business unit later to be comfortable with it and the business unit controller and get them to sign off and review the financial forecast and say, you missed something here. You missed a license that we might need. You missed the fact that their billing system can't be ripped out from their production system easily and pointed into our billing system, and we have to maintain that. There won't be a synergy there. And then there are other synergies you find. But a lot of times it helps you get the strength and comfort around having a conversation with an executive to say, this may actually be cheaper for us to just build ourselves.
You've touched on some very interesting elements there, Chris. I'd like to dig a little bit deeper. You've talked about modeling systems, obviously the role of the CFO. The old adage of timely, accurate reporting is never more important than today in a world where investor relations, the media, the analysts are all about hanging on that word of the investor, analyst, role of the CFO, speaking about it. Touch on how you have accommodated the need for that up-to-date systems information. You've talked about the challenges with that forward-looking, the forecasting, and the ability to make sure that it's accurate. How do you balance those forward-looking needs, those day-to-day monthly capture needs from a system and data perspective?
I think a lot of times, one of the hot buttons right now is operational dashboards. And as you're getting through each week, trending your revenue, for example, to see how things are going. A lot of the times, I think you have to address that working backwards and say, if I have a dashboard, I just don't want to, everyone says, oh, just project out what's going to happen for the month. But at the end of the day, there's more involved in that. And you have to think about how actionable is that dashboard going to be? Is this going to be kind of a tombstone telling me at the end really what's going to happen? Or is it actually something where I can pick up the phone and say, in the case of my last two companies, we need to increase marketing spend. Because if we increase marketing spend, we're going to get more calls in our call center. We're going to sell more subscriptions. And we can impact our revenue number at the end of the month. So I might be taking a hit on one cost item, but I'm going to be hitting a revenue goal. So the real thing is to work backwards and then ultimately say, if I know what I can impact and can impact, where's that data coming from? So if, for example, someone's buying things at a subscription level and it's a fixed rate every month, you're not going to impact that a whole lot. You're either signing on new subscriptions or they're canceling a certain rate. But if someone's transactionally driven, you can probably have a conversation somewhere if it's early enough in the month to drive a higher volume of transactions in and potentially lift your revenue.
Great, great. That's good lessons learned there. And obviously the CFO role not only involves that external analyst focus to the shareholders, to the general public, to the employees, but also internal management reporting. The CFO today often is managing the information systems. Perhaps they even have a CIO report to them. How can a CFO handle problem solving in a data-intensive world?
Yeah, I think, and again, this is something earlier choice point we ran into with a number of unique billing platforms and understanding customer trends and things like that. And you would have had to invest a ton of money to get really dynamic, robust systems in a large company with a lot of different technologies that interact with each other. So similar to the last discussion, it is looking at where the data resides that you ultimately need and working backwards from that. And if you have to pull things out and put them in what's called an OLAP cube, for example, and say, I need the following pieces of data. I just don't need the revenue number. I need exactly what someone's buying underneath that. And I also need to know the royalties associated with that. And put it in a separate cube and say, don't overthink the problem. Come up with a simple solution and say, we just need this to help us understand kind of nuances. But that's going to drive all the more sophisticated forecasting I have to do.
So the role of today's financial function is actually understanding data elements, understanding what is captured within that finance system, whether it be a forward-looking or a backward-looking system.
Right, correct. And you want something that's going to be dynamic enough, if you're in the data world and you're talking about royalties, that you can trend out and say, man, after I hit 10 million units, my royalty rate changes or it drops, or what can I do to impact those sort of things? And you're not going to know that necessarily just by seeing the revenue that posts to your P&L at the end of the month. You have to go backwards to a billing system, and typically in that case, backwards one more step to an actual functional system to say, where's the data loaded, how's it loaded, and then how are we tracking those data units?
Mm-hmm. Very challenging. And as we expand about the complexities of the CFO role, very often we hear about companies that are failing. We hear about companies that have had some kind of impact from an external source, obtaining inappropriate data. There can be very strong and very different elements. But the challenge that I see today for the CFO is that the role of leader in the CFO function is one often managing some kind of crisis, whether it's today's crisis of getting payroll run when the systems have collapsed, or whether it's some other kind of crisis, for example, the economic forces and the downturn in revenue. What lessons have you learned from your role as leading? You've been CFO, you've been COO, you've managed various elements of that finance and operations.
Yeah, I think in that scenario, you have to be honest. It's the honesty with the employees about what's going on. And when you do bankruptcy and turnaround work, the hard pill for people to swallow a lot of times is that 20% of the employees are going to go away. And it's having that conversation saying you can't focus on that. You got to focus on the 80% whose jobs you were saving and the realignment we're going through and what ultimately comes out of that. So I think being honest with the employees is you know, very important. I think honesty with kind of a caveat of you can't necessarily always tell them all the scenarios and everything that's being considered because people freak out. I mean, you talk to them about they've got to go home, they've got mortgages, they car payments, things like that, and you can't have someone hysterical. When I did crisis and turnaround in the beginning part of my career, I'd also have a parade of the brighter people who could figure out something was up coming into my office and saying, what do I need to do? And it's like, well, I think we're actually going to pull through this, and I don't want you going. But you do what you got to do for your family. If you want to go look for another job, you do it. But, you know, you have to make that assessment. The good news on the front part of my career with Ernst & Young is we only had one failure the whole time I was there where we were not able to restructure a company. And that was for a number of reasons. And, you know, it was very humbling. I mean, you're right out of grad school in my case. My first case, building a retail model, which understanding retail method of accounting is probably a 3-hour show for you. But going through that scenario and restructuring the company and closing stores, and those of you that are familiar with retail knows that it's all about your revolver. It's all about being able to fund Christmas and get enough inventory in the stores, have enough debt to float that inventory. And that's why retailers' year end is January 31st. They've sold all the inventory, they paid off their loans, and then you can tell how healthy a company is. But we, on this one particular engagement, had gone through an exercise of closing stores. And we had closed down to a certain number of stores and were not able to get enough profit, basically, to go forward. And so incredibly humbling experience going through that. But it kind of taught you, you know, your models can tell you so much and reality tells you another thing. And at some point, you have to make the decision it's not going to happen. And in this case, it was me sitting with the CFO at about, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning going through a payroll register and pulling a head out and saying, how many months before we blow our line? Pulling another head out and going through that. It was a bad moment, you know, but it was realistic. And so you have to detach and say, you've done everything you can. You've really worked hard at it. You've made, based on the best data available, what you thought were the best decisions. And even in the last few minutes of the night, I mean, this guy had nothing to gain from it. I had a lot of respect for him. He just wanted to keep the company going. And there was just nothing we could do. And it's a bad time. But sometimes you get to pull the plug and move on.
Mm. And in the same regard, you have had the excitement of managing and leading the finance function for Choice Points Incubator. Tell us about that. That's the emerging growth. It's new companies. It's fresh outlook. Did that give you different experiences?
That gave me a whole nother range of experiences because the way the incubator worked at Choice Point was the chairman would test out different ideas and ask people to get to a certain point of development to decide, are we going to go forward with this? And out of that business unit, we ran a DNA processing lab up at out of DC that processed 50,000 bone fragments for World Trade Center. So that was an interesting business to be involved in. We also did knowledge-based authentication. We did a biometric authentication, worked on that. And so there are a number of things that came out of that that were all kind of identity and data-related businesses, but we didn't have a big foothold in the front end. So it was a good way to go through. And it's also when you start saying, what do we need to do to build this business up? Do we need to buy somebody small and buy up some IP and move forward? Or do we architect things ourselves? And at what point, same thing, do you decide there's just not a business here? We had a few of those that you know, we made the decision not to go forward on. But it was very exciting. And then you get to the point where it gets big enough where it doesn't need to be, they'd call it the nursery. It doesn't need to be in the nursery anymore. It's a big boy, big girl now, and push it off into production. And then you have those other problems that you have on the M&A side, which is how do we build for this? How do we handle linking in our production servers with a billing server that's ultimately going to link to accounting. So similar to that. So you have to have those skills. Again, coming back to the, you know, how I evolved into the role evolved into me. You have to have those skills operationally to be able to sit down with technical people and say, these are the units, these are how they're passing, this is how the billing people like to see things, and what data do I ultimately need to preserve and what don't I need to preserve in order to get the system to work.
And when you look at those startup companies through that incubator model, are you focused primarily and solely on cash? Is it a multiple of cash flow? Is it a multiple of profit? Is it a multiple of looking at the balance sheet for valuation? Describe us through that process.
I mean, you're planning it almost like you'd be planning your brother-in-law's business in his garage. I mean, you're sitting there saying, I want to sell this. I'm not quite sure of the price point, and I know that there are people who have to support it. And it's really walking through that entire process. You were looking for ChoicePoint was an EVA company, which if you're familiar with EVA, it's basically looking at a return on your assets all the time. And you're looking to say, is this really at the end of the day going to be contributory or not to that? And then, you know, contributing to earnings. So when you're building out a pricing model to test things, you have to be incredibly careful. As you enter markets too, if you're entering a market like biometric authentication, it was relatively in its infancy at the time, and you come up with a price point, it's always keeping your eyes open who else is doing what. And I build my models out and say, we're assuming, let's say it's, you know, $30 a transaction, and it's going to be a transactional type business. But then you say, let's run the model at $15 or $12, because if you get a lot of competitors, all of a sudden all your assumptions are wrong. And anything, even if you've talked to some preliminary customers and they say, I think $30 a pop is going to be great, that may change, but then someone knocks on the door and offers them $15 or $12. So a lot of times I sensitize models that way. I sensitize my models for unanticipated costs like compliance or some third-party licensing that we maybe haven't thought of. But you learn as you go. As you start developing product, you can see what's out there, and you can say, well, you know what, this is something that we're better off licensing, or we're better off maintaining ourselves. And that's really what we learned. It was very exciting.
And this, I can imagine, is more support for the fact that the folks that are the analysts, that role is very much more a thinking role. It is not a repeat role in some regards the way the accounting function is, closing the general ledger and so forth. It's very much high demand, high thought pattern, high creativity.
Yeah, it is, and you have to be able to roll with it. And at Scientific Atlanta, I did equity investing for them, where our technology guys were identify something that was is worth investing in at the startup level. And it's almost the same math. Again, you know, the role choosing me, going out and saying, how many of these units do we need a year and why? And what's this business look like? What's the right capital structure? So you have to kind of roll with it and ultimately roll off of it. You make your investment in Scientific Atlanta's case. You would help a company go public. You would buy a good portion of their, you know, by them getting to use your name. You'd buy a good portion of their product and ultimately watch them go public. And at some point in time, there's a new technology, new something that you want to invest in. And you have cashed out your investment. You've gotten most favored nation pricing if you were buying a portion of it, which helps your gross margin. And you've gotten a nice return for shareholders. You've done what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One of the questions that I would like to ask you, Chris, is that the role of the CFO today often involves elements of operations. You have managed various elements of those in many aspects of your career, whether it be sales, product distribution, pricing, controls. Explain the CFO's role in this regard.
I think the CFO, at a macro level, if you look at how you can impact things and be involved operational, pricing controls is one of those more important things. You have marketing people and you have salespeople who tell you what's going on in the market and product development people. But at the end of the day, everyone knows you get that big deal on the table and everyone starts getting their calculators out and pulling down. And it's understanding, treating similar customers with a similar price point, maintaining that relationship so that no customer A says customer B is 2% smaller than me, but his price is half what you're charging me. Looking at those kinds of things that can really impact your reputation and roll through P&L. On the product side and product development side, it's really understanding why you're doing certain things. When capitalization is involved in particular, which, you know, means pushing costs down into your balance sheet to be aligned with revenue at a later point in time, why are we doing it this way? Is that cost reasonable? Is it not reasonable? Again, make versus buy decision comes in pretty quickly again. And maintaining controls in your eye on that stuff. You don't want to accidentally capitalize things that shouldn't have been capitalized. You don't want to do anything that would tarnish your company's reputation. So you need to keep it clean, and you need to make sure that everyone understands exactly why you're doing things and that you've got that rigor at all times to you know, basically stop something, even if it's midstream, and say, we're not going to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, we have a tradition. It is a new tradition for our radio show, but we are asking our guests to give us a tip of the month. Is there some particular element that you would like to leave our audience and our listeners with that as you have gone from company to company that's just served you well?
I've got three things, actually. But if you think through things, one we've mentioned and discussed a little bit, which is working backwards from your end goal. So in the case of a dashboard or reporting application, really saying, what am I trying to achieve here? What am I going to do with the information that's presented to me? And then working backwards and saying, where specifically does that data and information come through? So any project like that, I think it's the old work backwards to the raw data or to where it comes from, and understanding really the nuances of that data. For example, if there's data you don't capture currently, there's no sense in building an application to say, tell me how many of our customers are left-handed. I mean, if that's just data doesn't exist, it's silly. And if you really need to know that because you're designing a new product for left-handed people, well, then you got an issue. The other thing that has come up a lot when you start looking at software and different applications, or in my case in the incubator, and deciding, is the customer going to pay me transactionally for this, or are they going to pay a license, and what's that going to look like? As a pricing trick, I'd like looking at vendors that are already on board. So you look at your vendor list and say, wow, you know, I buy a license from, you know, say Oracle or something like that. Here's the way it's structured. Here's what we're able to negotiate it. Here's where we ended up. Is it a seat rate or is it fixed rate license? Those kinds of things are very valuable because it lets you start thinking how you think about things and what you find acceptable. So when your sales guy is presenting it to another CFO someplace, that CFO hopefully thinking a similar way to say, because you are at that point a vendor for them. But my favorite thing, and it's something that's often
so
overlooked.
Here comes the real CFO tip of the month.
The gold ring. Now, it actually goes all the way back to graduate school here at Georgia State. A professor named Pete Eisman taught us what's called sustainable growth rate theory. And what sustainable growth rate theory is understanding how quickly your company can grow without changing your capital structure or without impacting your capital structure or the relationship you have between debt and equity. So in other words, if you're sitting down and going through a strategic planning process and everyone's on board that we can grow this thing at 20% next year, it's getting comfortable with the math to say at 20%, I need an extra $1 million because based on how my receivables and payables and balance sheet are right now, I don't have capital to grow that fast. I grow great at 15%. 15% is the number. So, you know, we either dial it back or we plan for 20 and we have a conversation with an investor or a banker right now. The other benefit to understanding sustainable growth rate theory is you know how you can play with its components. You look at margins, obviously, and say, how much cash am I getting from every transaction? But it also gives you a chance to go back and look at your vendors and say, why is it that, you know, our accounts receivable are 75 days? Never happened to me professionally, to anyone you're listening. But, mm-hmm. but it, you know, you start looking at things like that to say, if I can dial those receivable days back through doing something else, like EFT or ACH transactions where I'm sweeping every month instead of waiting for a check to come in and clear. And maybe you change your terms for people who are willing to do that to 35 or 40 days. It's going to dial you back and it's going to help your cash flow, which means now your 20% goal is totally attainable.
Speed to cash helps it along through fast.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a great tip. Thank you very much. And what I would like to ask you in final is one question. In my introduction, I mentioned that you are a very active member of FEI, Financial Executive International. Tell us a little bit about that organization.
Yeah, it's a good organization to be part of. There's a national organization, there's a local chapter. The local chapter is mostly peer-to-peer networking. So I can talk to any controller or CFO around town about any business issue. When I was at My Choice Medical, we would talk about loan loss reserving and how we were dealing with our external auditors and our bankers to get them to a level of comfort. Were there tricks or what I would call sniff tests to say, am I reserving for this accurately or not? So at the local level, you get a lot of that. At a national level, it's really an advocacy and compliance organization. They have a research foundation that tells you the latest trends, and they provide high-level lobbying on our behalf. They talk to senators and things like that.
And how can our listeners go and find out more about FEI?
The national organization's financialexecutives.org, and you can see all about compliance and advocacy and the latest trends out there. At the local level, there's FEI Atlanta.org, which you can go to, and it will link you into membership services and what you need to do to become a member.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. And to our listeners today, this has been an interview with Chris Arndt. Thank you very much for sharing your innermost thoughts of the role of the CFO. We would like to thank our contributors for our news element, CFO.com, and to our sponsor, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses. If you would like to learn more about Delaney, please go to www.delaneyllc.com. And to our listeners out there, thank you very much for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time, this and other thought leadership about today's CFO is available right from your computer at www.cforadio.com.